or later on at least, the same person. Although, of course, he is in a different form, but he's still ultimately the same person. He is responsible for the distraction. So we were sort of... We gave a type of an answer yesterday, and I did check up on it. Oh, instantly, Vaidyanath Prabhu, do you have a Brahma Samhita? I have a spare one if you would like. So anyway, I did check and had some discussions, and there are different ways of looking at it, but the most really concrete thing I came across yesterday, it's in Srila Prabhupada's purport to the third canto, chapter 12, verse 11. 3.12.11. 3.12.11. And that is the chapter which is describing how the four Kumars are requested by Lord Brahma to become Prajapatis and increase the population, but they refuse, and Lord Brahma becomes angry, very angry actually, and from between his eyes comes Rudra, or the Shiva, who is actually the demigod Shiva, who is part of the, what they sometimes call the Trinity, Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva within this universe. So he is that Shiva. But then from that Shiva, well, he was already in a really, he was a manifestation of Lord Brahma's anger. So he was totally possessed by anger. But then from him came 11 other Rudras. And incidentally, Sundrananda Prabhu, the Yantra, there's 11 Rudras who came from the first Rudra, Lord Shiva, coming from Lord Brahma's forehead. They then proceeded to start trying to destroy the universe and do all sorts of obnoxious things, actually. They even attacked some of them, or one of them attacked Lord Brahma. So he approached the first Rudra, Lord Shiva himself, our demigod Shiva, and said, "You have to stop this, otherwise the whole universe will be destroyed, and we haven't even really begun properly yet. Or we're just beginning. So you must, this is not the time, so you must stop." So Lord Shiva, well actually Lord Brahma, instructed Lord Shiva that you and your friends, or your sort of partial expansions, what you must do is, you must go away and perform penances. In that way you'll become pacified. If you perform penance, you'll become more peaceful. And just hang on until the end of the universe, just a little while. Just hang on for, what is it, 4,320,000,000 years or so. Do some penances for a while, and then you can do your thing. So this is all described in the 12th chapter of the third canto. And particularly verse 11 is where everything is coming to a peak, or Shiva's just come out and it's all happening. The Rudras have just come out and they're starting to smash things up. So Srila Prabhupada gives a purport which is really basically what we said yesterday is in principle definitely consistent with. Let me just read part of this purport by Srila Prabhupada. Prabhupada says, "When lust and hankering are unsatisfied, the element of krodha or anger appears, which is the formidable enemy of the conditioned souls. This most sinful and inimical passion is represented as ahankara, or the false egocentric attitude of thinking oneself to be all in all. Such an egocentric attitude on the part of the conditioned soul, who is completely under the control of material nature, is described in Bhagavad Gita as foolish. The egocentric attitude is a manifestation of the Rudra principle in the heart, wherein krodha, anger, is generated. So basically the principle is, as we were saying yesterday, that this false ego which arises when Shambhu contacts Maya and the adulteration occurs due to the contact with Maya. In other words, the milk becomes yogurt, so to speak. Did we all mind? That produces the first feature of material consciousness, which is false ego. So that false ego, which is like the root, really, of all the other features of material consciousness. Thinking, I'm the enjoyer, I am this body, my program should be to satisfy my senses, and so on. So this is the Rudra principle, the principle of false ego. And it generates krodha. So when that is not being pacified, at that point it was pacified. As we mentioned, Lord Brahma gave this instruction that for the time being perform penance, and that will keep you all pacified for the next 4,320,000,000 or so years. And then you can do your angry activities. So at the end of the universe, this anger is not pacified. They come out of their penance. Lord Brahma is dying. He's no longer able to control them by giving good direction. Lord Vishnu withdraws his maintaining potency, understanding what is his own plan. And then the Rudras again, their krodha, which is rooted in ahankara, which is like the fundamental factor in their natures, then they destroy. So that is there, coming from Srila Prabhupada. Actually, Brahma told Shiva that you perform penance, and when we need you, we'll call you. So Lord Brahma, as he was about to sort of bow out, it would appear, well, of course it hasn't happened yet, but when the time comes, he will call out, okay, now you can do it. Now you can stop your penances. So today we're going to go through verses 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, and 21 fairly quickly. Then we'll go over the questions for the test, and then you can prepare yourselves for the test. And the test is tomorrow. And you're all welcome to take the test. Actually, you should all take the test. How's that? Is that okay? Should all take the test. Let's try and take this seriously. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So we can recite text 16 responsively. Ahankaratmakam Vishvam. Tasmadetad Vijayata. Translation: the function of Shambhu in relation to Jivas is that this universe enshrining the mundane egotistic principle has originated from Shambhu. Well, it's the first mention of the jivas, I think, if I'm not mistaken. I think it's the first mention of the jivas. And it's really a point which we've already come across. It's already been described. There appear to be verses sometimes here which restate points already made. So this point has already been there, that Shambhu, his function, well, of course, this is here specifically in relation to the jivas. It's just been talked about in general in terms of the unfolding of the Mahatattva, really, so far. But here, in relation to the jivas, the function of Shambhu is that he provides the mundane, egotistic principle, false ego. That is, well, we've talked about that quite a bit. So that's coming from Shambhu. In the purport, well, let's go through the purport a little bit. First part of the purport, first few lines, he's talking about how in the spiritual world, the basic principle is that there isn't this egotism. In this sense, egotism means that I think I'm the independent enjoyer, like that. So in the spiritual world, there is not that. All the living entities are devoid of the separating egotisms. And the basic principle is the Supreme Lord himself. So they're all focused on him as his servants. But then, going down a little further, in the material world, the living entities manifest as separated egotistic symbols, which basically means they have their false ego. Each one is thinking, I'm very important, I must look after me, and all the others, well, you know, I have to watch out for them and make sure they don't get the better of me, and I must get the better of them if I can. This is the whole idea of false ego. So that is the reflection of the chit, the influence of the chit potency. The chit potency, not the reflection of it, but the actual chit potency, encourages the idea that we are devotees. But the reflection of the chit potency, which is this potency of false ego, it encourages this separateness and false ego. So then he goes on to actually make a fairly interesting point down the bottom of the page. At this function, Shambhu is nothing but the mere material causal principle, embodying the extension in the shape of ingredient as matter. So he's referring to him as being a principle. Again, when in course of the progressive evolution of mundane creation, each universe is manifested, then in the principle of Shambhu, born of the space between the two eyebrows of Vishnu, there appears the manifestation of the personality of Rudra. Anyway, he's basically saying that the Shambhu we've been talking about, the glance, is more like a principle, and he becomes personified a little later on as the creation continues as Rudra. Anyway, one way or the other, under all circumstances, Shambhu fully enshrines the mundane egotistic principle. So then the next several lines, he's basically repeating the point about how the devotees, when they come out of Mahavishnu, if they really are devotees, or at least if they become devotees, then they know themselves to be the eternal servants of the Supreme Lord, and they're then incorporated into the realm of Vaikuntha. So then they go back to Godhead. However, when they desire to lord it over Maya, forgetting their real identity, then the egotistic principle Shambhu enters into their entities and makes them identify themselves as separated enjoyers of mundane things. So this principle of Shambhu, this potency of Shambhu, false ego, perverted cognition, enters the heart of those living entities who are not devotees, and in this way they then get involved in material life. So everyone in the material world, of course, is under the influence of false ego, including all of us probably, although we're trying to become devotees and get free of it all, but still it's there. So in this way, to whatever degree we may be influenced by false ego, we're under the influence of Shambhu. And because of that, you know, then we may try to enjoy independently in one way or another. And as a result, we get frustrated because you can't really succeed in enjoying. And when you become, enjoying independently at least, and when you become frustrated, you become angry and upset and frustrated and so on and so forth. And that's, anger comes, and this is what the Rudra principle is about. The false ego principle leads to that frustration and anger due to failure in trying to enjoy in that false ego way. Let's go on to text 17. I'll just read the translation. Thereupon the same great personal Godhead, assuming the threefold forms of Vishnu, Prajapati and Shambhu, entering into the mundane universe, plays the pastimes of preservation, creation and destruction of this world. This pastime is contained in the mundane world. Hence, it being perverted, the Supreme Lord, identical with Mahavishnu, prefers to consort with the goddess Yoga Nidra, the constituent of his own spiritual potency, full of the ecstatic trance of eternal bliss pertaining to his own divine personality. So, here we're talking about, it appears that we're going into the universes. Anyway, some expanded forms, an expanded form of Vishnu, identical with Mahavishnu, and then Prajapati and Shambhu, they associate with their consorts. Prajapati and Shambhu, they are sporting in a somewhat separate way, but Lord Vishnu, he doesn't want to do like that, so he withdraws. He doesn't get involved in that, but he enjoys his transcendental pastimes with Rama or Lakshmi or Yoga Nidra. Text 18. When Vishnu, lying in the ocean of milk, wills to create this universe, a golden lotus springs from his navel pit. Now we are definitely, the verse before, it's a little tricky to understand exactly who. Are these the Vishnu, Prajapati and Shambhu within this actual universe, or these prototypes? I think they're the prototypes. But in 18 it's very clear, we are now within the universe. But then again, it may not appear to be so clear. We made reference to this yesterday. One aspect of it at least. When Vishnu, lying in the ocean of milk, wills to create this universe, a golden lotus springs from his navel pit. The golden lotus with its stem is the abode of Brahma, representing Brahmaloka or Satyaloka. Now, do you notice anything there which sounds a little unusual, according to your understanding of how these things work? Brihat? Is that, you know, the Vishnu lying in the ocean of milk normally is Shiradakshai Vishnu, right? But actually, the golden lotus which Lord Brahma appears on top of normally comes from Garbhadakshai Vishnu, doesn't it? Yes. Well, not yeah, in the Garbhadak ocean. Yeah. So what is happening here? Well, from according to my understanding, and I have a number of quotes actually from Srila Prabhupada where he refers to this. An important point to bear in mind here is, as we have mentioned, and as Brahma Samhita has also stated, there is no difference between these Vishnus. These are not three people. These are one person manifesting in three different ways. So sometimes some sort of interchangeability may possibly be there. In other words, certain aspects of one may be attributed to another. Here, an attribute of Shiradakshai Vishnu is attributed to Garbhadakshai Vishnu, or vice versa. Now, you could say that an attribute of Garbhadakshai Vishnu, which is that the lotus comes from his navel, that is now being attributed to Shiradakshai Vishnu. But according to my understanding, actually what is happening is that Garbhadakshai Vishnu is manifesting the lotus as normal, which is his normal function. And Lord Brahma is shortly going to appear from it. But because there's this oneness, then he's being referred to in these terms. And just to substantiate that, I'm going to read some excerpts from some of Srila Prabhupada's purports where he talks in similar terms. So Prabhupada says, actually, unfortunately, I don't have the verse references, but if anyone really wanted them, I could provide them. Describing the features of the three Purushas, the Laghu Bhagavatamrita says that Garbhadakshai Vishnu has a four-handed form. And when he himself enters the hollow of the universe and lies down in the ocean of milk, he is known as Shiradakshai Vishnu, who is the supersoul of all living entities, including the demigods. This Shiradakshai Vishnu is an expansion of Garbhadakshai Vishnu for pastimes. So they're being spoken of as one, but then, I mean, initially, Prabhupada says that Garbhadakshai Vishnu enters the hollow of the universe and lies down in the ocean of milk. But then Prabhupada says, this Shiradakshai Vishnu is an expansion of Garbhadakshai Vishnu for pastimes. So some oneness, some difference. Then Prabhupada, another quote, Prabhupada says, so Brahma was approached by the earth, Mother Earth. She felt overburdened by the sinful activities of the demons. So Brahma approaches Vishnu. Not directly he can see, but he can stand on the bank of the ocean of milk. And from there he can submit his petition. And Garbhadakshai Vishnu gives his order. So, just see, same thing happens. Garbhadakshai Vishnu gives his order. Actually, it's Shiradakshai Vishnu. But, you know, I take it that because there is this, you know, like a very clear sense of oneness between them. Prabhupada's just saying like that, and it's not a mistake. So once upon a time when the whole world was overburdened, this is the history of Krishna's birth. So the earthly planet approached Brahma to appeal to Garbhadakshai Vishnu. Actually, it was Shiva and Akshaya Vishnu, but they're one. So, and then a third quote from another, well, that was from a lecture, I guess, by the language, and this, I think, is also. And then Garbhadakshay, the universes are created. Then when they develop, then same Vishnu, Mahavishnu, enters into each universe and he creates an ocean. That is called Garbhada Ocean. So same Vishnu enters the universe and creates the Garbhada Vishnu. And he lies down there on Sheshanaga. Actually it's Garbhadakshay Vishnu, if you want to be specific about it. But because they're one, then to say that it's Mahavishnu is also not inappropriate. And then from the navel the lotus flower sprouts, and then Lord Brahma is created. Then after many years, tapasya, tapo, he understands how to create. In this way, the whole creation of universes takes place, Garbhadakshay. And after creation of this universe, then same Vishnu, Garbhadakshay, within this universe, he creates his own Vaikuntha where there is an ocean of milk. So in this way, I think we can safely say that this Vishnu being described in text 18 is Garbhadakshay Vishnu. But it's being expressed in this sort of oneness sense, because later on, or you know, at some point in this whole procedure, Garbhadakshay Vishnu, as Sharadakshay Vishnu, does lie down in the ocean of milk. Madan Mohan? We also noticed. Yes. Well, you are now asking me to, you know, express the mind of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, and I wouldn't be capable of doing that. But I would, from what I can see, this principle I've just been trying to describe, I think that principle applies. I mean, the point you've made is quite correct. The Sanskrit does not mention an ocean of milk. But there's no harm. See, his style of translating, and particularly Srila Prabhupada's style of translating, it's called a commentative style of translating. Yeah. It's a particular style of translating. Hridayananda Maharaj, who's, you know, a big Sanskrit expert pretty much, he has suggested that he might present a translation of Srimad Bhagavatam, just of the translations only, in a non-commentative form, in a more literal form. Yeah. So anyway, I assume that principle applies here. Yeah. Okay. Let's carry on. In fact, let us just move on quickly, because I have to tell you your questions, don't I? Text 19. Before their conglomeration. Now this is a little tricky. I actually find this rather tricky, I must admit. Before their conglomeration, the primary elements in their nascent state. Nascent means like before they are kind of, I mean, it's related with birth, like that. Yeah. Anyway, before, in their nascent state means before they're acted upon or combined in any way. They remained originally separate entities. So they were conglomerated before as Pradhan. Right? Are you with me? They were conglomerated. They just became unconglomerated as Mahatattva. Right? All the individual elements were taken out and located in their individual positions, recognizably separate from each other. And then they were distributed amongst the universes. So each universe now has a stock of the different elements which will be used for putting together the planetary systems and everything. So before their conglomeration here appears to mean to me that before Lord Brahma gets to work with all these ingredients, earth, water, fire, air, ether particularly, and the various other ingredients, then they were separated within each universe. Non-application of the conglomerating process is the cause of their separate existence. Well, anyway, it's just kind of restating. Lord Brahma has not got to work yet, conglomerating them and making the different material forms. So then, Divine Mahavishnu, Primal Godhead, through association with His own spiritual potency, Chit potency, moved Maya, and by the application of the conglomerating principle, created those different entities in their state of cooperation. And after that, He Himself consorted with Yoga Nidra by way of His eternal dalliance with His spiritual potency. You know, considering there's a little bit of a lack of time right now, I don't think we really need to go into this, because this is, I think, essentially repeating some information we've already discussed. But the main point, I think, really, is that after doing what He's done, Mahavishnu goes back to His pastimes with Rama, basically. And now the whole material process of creation is going to go on. He's already set it up. He is not directly going to participate further. He is not really going to participate further, but rather Garbhadakshay Vishnu is, and Lord Brahma. They are now going to carry on the procedure. Mahavishnu has glanced, so he has done basically his part. Does that sound okay? Text 20. By conglomerating all those separate entities, He manifested the innumerable mundane universes, and Himself entered into the inmost recess of every extended conglomerate. At that time, those jivas who had lain dormant during the cataclysm were awakened. So now, Shiradakshay Vishnu, this is Shiradakshay Vishnu, He is entering into every atom. And the jivas, if you remember, we showed them on the board, going down through the glands. So at some time, they went through the glands, they were put in the individual universes. Now they're starting to wake up. And in text 22, which we're going to be doing on, you know, next week, so to speak, on Thursday, then Lord Brahma actually comes and everything becomes totally activated. But now the jivas at least are starting to become active. And text 21. The same jiva is eternal and is for eternity and without a beginning, joined to the Supreme Lord by the tie of an eternal kinship. He is transcendental spiritual potency. So this is descriptive, describing the jiva. If we go through the purport, we'll see that there are a number of characteristics. There's about 8. Right at the beginning, it says, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta says, that the jivas are eternally joined with Krishna, just as the sun is eternally associated with His rays. Well, we should say the Supreme Lord is joined with the jivas, just as the sun is eternally associated with His rays. Then, a little further down, he says that they are not perishable, they're eternal, infinitesimal particles of His spiritual effulgence. Then a little further down, they minutely display the qualities of Krishna. Hence, they have knowledge, they are knowers, they have a sense of identity, a sense of enjoying, they can think, they can do, just as Krishna can, they can. And a little further down again, they're transcendental, about halfway down. They are his transcendental potency. A little further down again, about three quarters of the way down, they're tatastha or marginal potency. A little further down again, they are susceptible to the influence of the material energy. Why? Because they're small. Because they're very small. However, at the end of the purport, as long as the jiva remains submissive to Krishna, who is the Lord of Maya, he will not be influenced by Maya. Otherwise, if he doesn't remain submissive, then since time immemorial, he's been undergoing birth, death, and everything else, and will continue to. So, that briefly is a little overview of those verses. Does anyone have any comments or questions? Innumerable jivas as spiritual particles emanating from the Oversoul in the form of pencils of rays of effulgence have no relation with the mundane world when they come to know themselves to be the eternal servants of the Supreme Lord. Well, I would say not. I would say not. Or I would say not necessarily at all. You know, the fact is that as conditioned souls, when each creation is destroyed, and then they all go back into Mahavishnu. So that has been going on for a long time. We've gone in and out of Mahavishnu many times. Yeah. So he just says that the innumerable jivas as spiritual particles, that they emanate from the Oversoul, which is Mahavishnu. So that's true. At the time of creation, they emanate again. I mean, they have to come out. They can't stay in him. So they emanate. They come out. Yeah, they go actually through the glands. Yeah. And the way they do that, it's something like pencils of rays of effulgence. You know, very rapidly, they pass through the glands. So I don't think that, you know, particularly when we understand that at the end of the previous manifestation, everything's destroyed, they all go back into Mahavishnu. And now here we are at the beginning of another creation, so they have to go back in. If we understand in those terms, then I don't think there's, you know, a real problem. Personally, I don't know what you think. It doesn't say that they're originating so much. Yes. Well, that's just his way of saying they go back to Godhead. Yes. His use of language. You know, we don't use language exactly the way he does sometimes. So if when they come out, they become pure devotees, then they're incorporated, then they go back to Godhead. And see, then there's another point. And this, in the long run, is a more important point because you didn't mention, although we mentioned yesterday, that back in text 11 does say, Lord Brahma does say, that Mahavishnu is the creator of thousands of individual souls. Now, if anything were to support, you know, something along the lines of what you were suggesting, that maybe we come from the Brahma Jyoti, or maybe we were actually non-existent, but then we were created by Mahavishnu. Well, that would seem to, you know, support that. But the thing is, and Jiva Goswami discusses this at great length in Krishna Sandarbha, and it's a very important point, is that sometimes, due to there being a certain context in a scripture, the speaker may present a particular point in a way which, due to the context, is kind of uncharacteristic for how that point is normally expressed. Like here, you know, in text 10, it definitely sounds like they're not eternal. Right? The individual soul. It definitely sounds like that. He is the creator of so many individual souls. So, you know, someone might say, aha, we have now found the answer. And then they may write a book about it. And think up some clever name like, what is it, in Vaikuntha, even the leaves do not fall, or something like that. Anyway, the thing is that when there are certain specific circumstances under which a statement is being made, then a statement may be made about a subject which is, you know, commonly discussed, but due to the circumstances, there it may be discussed in a slightly different way. So rather than think that all the other places, like in this case, all the other places where it says the soul, the individual living entities are eternal, rather than think that all those other statements are wrong and this isolated statement is now right, you know, and can supersede all the other statements, actually we should understand it's the other way round. Yeah. And look for an understanding. Actually, look for an understanding in terms of the commonly accepted understanding. Jiva Goswami talks about this because he's particularly talking about it in regard to the idea that Krishna is the original supreme personality of Godhead. He is the number one original. So Jiva Goswami points out, and he actually states the verses. There are a few verses which express things in such a way that it appears that Krishna is not the original Supreme Personality of Godhead. Just a few. Like, for example, when Arjuna and Krishna went to Mahavishnu to retrieve the children of that Brahmin couple, then Mahavishnu tells Krishna, that you should finish your pastimes and come back to me. In other words, you might think Krishna is an incarnation of Mahavishnu. That's the idea being presented. However, elsewhere, in many, many places, there are statements that Krishna is the original Supreme Personality of Godhead and Mahavishnu is coming from him. So Jiva Goswami says, we should then accept the general principle which has been established in so many places. And when we come across these odd places where some other idea is presented, then we should actually interpret those in terms of the general understanding. And in this particular case regarding Mahavishnu, Jiva Goswami gives a very nice and very interesting explanation is that this is Mahavishnu's opinion. Yes, Mahavishnu thinks like this. Actually, he's not right. He is just expressing his idea. And he's thinking, yes, you're the incarnation of me. You came from me. But he's not correct. Yes, and anyway, we won't go into that. Not that he's really in Maya. And maybe he's in Yoga Maya or something like that. But it's not entirely correct. Yeah. So here, you know, sometimes we come across statements like this. But we should understand that we're all eternal. We haven't come from the Brahma Jyoti. We haven't come from Mahavishnu. You know, we haven't come from anywhere really. We are eternal. And on that note, he manifests, when he contacts Maya, then a certain principle of material consciousness manifests. Is that okay?